meeting of Parliament, Thursday, 22nd of November 2018, order proceedings. The State of Standing Order, the Honourable the Chief Minister. Mr. Speaker, I beg to move under Standing Order 7.3 to the same Standing Order 7.1 in order to proceed with the government's statement. Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Carried. Mr. Speaker, despite the parallel storm that has been raging on Gibraltar-related matters, I was here yesterday from the group with the government's working team, where we have negotiated the final details of the package of measures that will apply to Gibraltar in the context of our withdrawal from the European Union together with the United Kingdom. This morning, I briefed the Cabinet and the members of the Brexit Select Committee. I expect to make a full ministerial statement to the nation on the nature and effects of these Gibraltar measures sometime next week. By then, we hope the European Summit to be held on Sunday, the 25th of November, will have reached a final agreement on the draft withdrawal agreement and a political declaration which has just been published and would set out a framework for the future relationship between the European Union and the United Kingdom. Today, I will update the Parliament on the progress made in this week's negotiations in Madrid and the meeting held with the Prime Minister in Downing Street last week. The decision of the withdrawal agreement, as all members know, contains a protocol on Gibraltar. The protocol refers to a series of memoranda of understanding and a text treaty that will underpin the operation of the protocol. Those are the documents that we've been discussing. And I'm glad to report today that agreement on all of these documents is now virtually complete, subject to a common final political agreement. Work has been finalized from negotiations and sections in respect of all matters. The four MOUs concern citizens' rights, tobacco market access, corporation and environmental matters, and corporation and police and customs matters. The tax treaty sets out provisions on fiscal transparency and tax residency rules, typical of what is found in a double taxation or information exchange agreement. Those types of agreements that we have with many countries around the world and which we have long wished to have the same. All of these MOUs, except for the tax treaty and the citizens' rights MOU, create obligations only until the end of December 2020. That is to say, Mr. Speaker, these agreements are only for the 21 months of the so-called transition period between March 2019 and December 2020. Unless we agree otherwise, they drop dead then. All of these documents are the product of a long and intensive negotiation that has lasted virtually the whole year. Nothing in these documents compromises any of our red lines. Nothing in them alters in any way whatsoever our constitution and our constitutional competences. There are and there will be no concessions on matters of sovereignty, jurisdiction or control. In fact, there are expressly arrangements entered into without prejudice to all sovereignty positions. Indeed, neither do these documents require us to do things that we have any problem in doing. I can assure all members that the terms of the MOU are far removed from what others might have wished them to contain. The people are now presently engaged in a legal grab and test federalization of the documents and the necessary translation of them, and we're confident that they will be ready for final political agreements and approvals by Sunday. This means that as long as the Special European Summit on Sunday reaches final agreement between the EU 27 and the United Kingdom, the terms on which Gibraltar will form part of the withdrawal agreement have been finalized, and Gibraltar will benefit from the transition period. This is what was said at this stage of the complex Brexit negotiations, and this is that we are on the verge of achieving. Mr. Speaker, our objective for the first phase of the Brexit negotiations was to secure continued access to the UK market. We achieved that in October last year. We're now on the verge of securing our objective for the second phase of the Brexit negotiations, that is to say, our inclusion in the withdrawal agreement and the transitional period. It is of critical importance that we bear in mind that without our inclusion in the withdrawal agreement, Gibraltar alone would have faced a Gibraltar, but not to Gibraltar. The Speaker, this was not the result we would have wanted. It would provide no certainty to businesses and to individuals. It is therefore with a great sense of satisfaction that I am able to attend the House today, but notwithstanding the threats that we have faced, notwithstanding the considerable challenges that we have faced, notwithstanding the claims that some voices have wrongly suggested that Britain presented Spain with the best opportunity we've had in the last 300 years to acquire sovereignty or some part of it over Gibraltar, Gibraltar will nonetheless, and despite all that, be part of any withdrawal agreement and transitional period. This is secured, Mr. Speaker, a vital period of legal certainty for businesses and citizens that will last until at least the 31st of December 2020, and during which the future partnership between the United Kingdom, including Gibraltar, and the EU will be negotiated. To the memorandum of understanding in the past treaty will be accompanied by a number of other documents, letters and political declarations, all of which are also being finalized as I speak. All of these documents form a single package that must be read and understood as such. I will explain them in some detail in my ministerial statement once they have all been finalized and the EU27 and the UK have reached an agreement on the withdrawal process. There are two additional points I would like to make. Firstly, during the course of this week, the Spanish government has publicly expressed its misgivings with how Gibraltar has been treated in relation to one aspect of the withdrawal agreement. This concerns Article 1 and 4 of the agreement, which Spain interprets as compromising the role of Britain to play in determining how the UK's future partnership with the EU will apply to Gibraltar. Let it be clear that this has nothing to do with what we have been negotiating, which is the terms of the differentiated involvement in the withdrawal agreement for Gibraltar and our inclusion in the transitional period, and not the terms of the future relationship with the EU. That is not what we are dealing with at this point. Indeed, Britain has criticized the Gibraltar government for not having obtained now a more enduring and permanent deal for Gibraltar at this stage of the negotiations, but continue to profoundly misunderstand how the Brexit negotiations have been conducted and how the legal text must be interpreted. Perhaps the events of the last 72 hours have managed to clarify this. Secondly, Mr. Speaker, the memorandum from the text we have been negotiating underpins the operation of the Gibraltar Protocol that forms an integral part of the withdrawal agreement. They are therefore the product of requirements contained in the withdrawal agreement. That agreement is an EU treaty, which is a formal binding treaty under international law entered into by sovereign states. Gibraltar is constitutionally not and constitutionally cannot be a separate party to such an agreement. Instead, it is important that the protocol and the MOUs are understood in the light of recital 2 of the protocol, which states that the protocol is to be implemented in accordance with the respective constitutional orders of the United Kingdom and Spain. This recognizes that the rights and obligations set out in the protocol and the memorandum are enjoyed and performed by the Gibraltar government in accordance with the terms of our constitution. This matter was specifically confirmed in my meeting with the Prime Minister in Downing Street last week. Therefore, nothing has been imposed on us, and nothing will be done which is not in accordance with our constitution. All the commitments entered into, whether under the protocol or the MOU, concerning Gibraltar, have been negotiated by Gibraltar and the United Kingdom together. There are commitments entered into only as a result of the consent of the Cabinet of the United States Government of Gibraltar having been expressly given. The government is the guardian of the Constitution as much as this legislature or the judiciary may be. We would not have countenance agreeing to anything which might have resulted in our constitutional order somehow being compromised. Mr. Speaker, assuming all other hurdles to agreements are therefore surmounted, we must now also start to consider in greater detail what our future relationship with the EU will be after the deal. In great measure, this is also a consideration of what we want our relationship to be with Spain, our neighbour, after the departure from the EU. We have never questioned that geographically we act with Europe, principally with Spain. Our geographic gateway to Europe is Spain. We therefore no reason for cooperation and discussing with Spain remaining 27 nations. So I wish to continue in our discussions about the future, to engage directly with Spain also in the spirit of cooperation and positive engagement we have enjoyed in this withdrawal phase of the negotiations. No one should think that we need any part of the withdrawal agreement in any way that would persuade us to avoid that genuine human and political reality. Nobody needs a veto to bring us to a table. Welcome, Mr. Speaker. Gibraltar and its people have been left behind the fog of international legal theory. At this critical time in Europe's history, Gibraltar can be the strongest foundation to stone for a future relationship between the UK and the EU, not a rock on the road to agreement. That is our firm commitment and resolve. Mr. Speaker, as far as we're concerned, Brexit is a bad thing for the whole of Europe. Brexit without an agreement or orderly agreed withdrawal would be an even worse thing for the whole of Europe. And for us, Mr. Speaker, Brexit is as bad an idea today in reality as it was in theory at the time of the referendum. But for us, Mr. Speaker, it is always best if we stick with Britain despite Brexit. We have stuck with Britain in the past, and we will stick with Britain in the future. I look forward to the publication of the memorandums and to presenting their content and effect with colleagues in this House, and I will be happy to clarify any part of my statement that honourable members wish to clarify today.
The honourable the leader of the system.
Mr. Speaker, conscious of your warning, we appreciate the indication that we will be permitted an opportunity to respond to the government's statement on the current position as regards Brexit and its impact on Gibraltar. It is important, as Her Majesty's Law of Opposition, to reflect on the momentous weakness in politics both here and in London. Mr. Speaker, whilst we are optimistic and a positive community, there is a growing concern amongst many in our community as to what positive measures have been secured for Gibraltar as a result of this process, for which the Chief Minister and his team are said to have worked day and night on the last 2 years. Clearly, we all want to achieve the best deal for Gibraltar, and to that extent, of course, the government has had our support in these negotiations. Mr. Speaker, we did not wish to leave the EU, so any deal will be worse than remaining in the EU. Mr. Speaker, the Chief Minister on the 15th of November issued a statement confirming that the number one priority of the Gibraltar government has been achieved. Namely, the terms of the withdrawal agreement and the transition period will apply to Gibraltar, and that as a consequence, Gibraltar will not back out of the EU in March of 2019. And the things will largely remain as they are until the end of 2020. The Chief Minister also confirmed that the government of Gibraltar has been fully involved in the negotiations as they affected Gibraltar, whilst also stating that the withdrawal agreement, the Gibraltar Protocol, and the underlying memoranda will come to an end on the 31st of December 2020, of course, with exception to the two that the Chief Minister highlighted in his contribution just now. The Chief Minister has been steadfast in his support for Mrs. May's efforts and fast to confirm that the deal is good for the UK and therefore Gibraltar as a member of the UK family. Mr. Speaker, the Chief Minister has issued several conclusions. One, that the withdrawal agreement or the deal, subject to the formal agreement and ratification by the EU and the UK, is far better for Gibraltar than backing out of the EU in 4 months' time. That the protocol contains absolutely no concessions on sovereignty, jurisdiction, and or control. And there are no issues of bilateralism that can cause any concerns. Three, there are no matters which in any way change our fundamental position on key issues. Fourthly, the Chief Minister confirmed on the 15th of November that he would expect to make a ministerial statement explaining the protocol and the memoranda this week. He has now confirmed that by during the course of next week, those memoranda will be explained in detail to the people in a statement of the nation. In summing up, The chief minister confirmed that he was satisfied, and he again repeated that word today, that the aspect of the proposed Whitlam agreement with related to those work for the Baltics. Mr. Speaker, a magistrate opposition provided its initial reaction on the same day, and we stated that it was too early to do a complete evaluation of the impact of the deal on Gibraltar. Mr. Speaker, it is clear that the protocol refers to at least four UK-Spain memorandum. These have not been published, and we have not been allowed a advance copy of these documents, so as to be able to study their content and implications. We understand that there are other documents that the Chief Minister and his team are working on. Therefore, we will need to carefully analyse and evaluate their impact once they are published in full, to assess whether this is the best deal for Gibraltar in all the circumstances, or whether they contain features which are adverse to our interests. Mr. Speaker, we acknowledge that we have had briefings from time to time ahead of all public statements by the Chief Minister. And when the remaining documents are available, we will refer the matter to the party's budget policy group to review. Thereafter, Mr. Speaker, we will make a statement on our view of whether this is good or a bad deal for Gibraltar. Mr. Speaker, the latest demand by the Spanish Foreign Minister and Spanish Prime Minister in recent days, calling for our exclusion from negotiations as to the UK's future relationship with the EU for the Whitlam Agreement, until our future relationship has been negotiated bilaterally between the UK and Spain, is clearly unacceptable. At best, it reflects Spanish party politics, political engineering, and playing to Spain's domestic audience, or at worst, it represents more than just an 11th hour spanner in the world. We will all hold our collective breath to see how the next few weeks pans out. There has also been, Mr. Speaker, speculation in Spain, where the government there will table a proposal for joint sovereignty in the context of our exit from the EU and the future relationship. Certainly from these centuries opposite, this is entirely unacceptable to the opposition and the people of the world. Mr. Speaker, the position of the Spanish government raises further concerns, as the Spanish government's commitment to adhere to any agreement over the Gibraltar. For now, we'll reserve our assessment until such time as the position becomes clearer, but continue to express our misgivings. I am sure that we share the dismay of the whole House, that Spain should be seeking to exclude Gibraltar from negotiations on the future relationship with the EU until it gains a political advantage. The government will need to remain vigilant that nothing has changed in the current text of the Whitlam Agreement to further undermine Gibraltar's position. Speaker, we fully appreciate that the Whitlam Agreement is central in nature, in large measure, but we have expressed our initial misgivings about whether the Whitlam Agreement, the Gibraltar Protocol, or the full memoranda and the fact that meet our objectives to lay the ground to secure actual benefits for the people of Gibraltar and our businesses beyond a very short 21-month period. Mr. Speaker, we have also questioned whether Gibraltar has lost time over the last 2 years towards the opportunity of recalibrating our relationship with the EU on a more permanent basis, or whether this sort of arrangement represents an intrusion into our affairs by Spain. We await the publication of the document so that we can make a full evaluation. We think the sooner the government publishes these documents, the better, so that the public can make up their own minds on such issues. We will not rush to judgment on such questions. On another note, Mr. Speaker, there remains a significant concern in our community in relation to our readiness and preparedness for a no-deal Brexit. Mr. Speaker, we have been told that there are detailed contingency plans for all levels of Brexit, and we would appreciate clarity as to what levels of Brexit the government are referring to. Mr. Speaker, we have understood that these are challenging times, which on the people of his own assessment are difficult and dangerous. There have been times in our history where we have faced challenges together, and we have offered to assist the government on Brexit in a spirit of unity. The government has chosen to shoulder the full burden of this challenge and simply provide the opposition with briefings from time to time. That is their right, and of course that has meant that we have not had any effective ability to participate or influence the shape of these arrangements, that we will now have to fully and properly scrutinise once the documents are published. The government has had significant leeway from us, a political space, to negotiate and conclude these agreements, which we have given in the best spirit and in the public interest. Mr. Speaker, there is much political speculation as to whether the Brexit deal, if concluded by the European Council on Sunday, will make it through the British Parliament in December, and the consequences if that were not to happen. We must be ready, Mr. Speaker, for any eventuality in this constantly evolving process. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, there are growing voices in the UK that some people vote or set a referendum. If the Brexit deal does not make it through the Parliament, as things stand, Mr. Speaker, this may look unlikely. But for our part, we have made it clear that within the UK political dynamic, momentum grows so that there is a vote on either supporting this Brexit deal or remaining in the EU, we would support such a vote. I must accept that there will be a month ahead of constantly shifting plans in this process today. We do not set up our store on this possibility and agree we should be concentrating on the emerging Brexit deal and whether it is ultimately good for the people of the world.
Minister, I will talk to the Honourable Gentleman for his statement in respect of what I said to the House today, and I detail a number of points which I think you have asked for my clarification on, so I shall endeavour to provide it as succinctly as I can. Because, yes, there are all the memoranda, which we have not yet published, but I think it is important that Honourable Members reflect to the whole community that they have seen the memoranda as every state of their development. They have not been able to take copies away, and I recognize that as a full analysis requires one to be able to review the documentation. The members of the Brexit Select Committee have been able to see the documentation. And I have today, during the course of the briefing we have had, informed them that as soon as we have what is known in this business into which we have been thrown as a stabilization, in other words, when we have the final test, and we are not the final test yet, it's still being going through legal scrub, as I told the House, we will endeavour to provide it to honourable members immediately, even though that may not be the date of publication, so they can start doing their assessment. And the thought, the Speaker, that they have understood now that these are, at the moment, unpublishable tests because they are not yet still being checked. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman then took us to the issue of the topical Article 3, Article 1 of 4 Reader Cross in the withdrawal agreement, and the issue of how Spain, in his interpretation, was throwing an 11th-hour spanner in the works. And I think it's a reference to a statement that we ourselves issued earlier in the week when the issue first arose. So I think the important thing that we need to make clear, I think the message that the government is sending, the message that the whole parliament is sending, and that we have been sending as a community for many generations, is that Spain does not need a veto to get it to a table. In other words, the fourth largest economy in Europe does not need a whip to get the smallest economy in Europe to sit round the table with it and have a meaningful discussion about cooperation. We genuinely, I think, from all sides of the community, believe that as long as we are not talking about issues relating to sovereignty or jurisdictional control, all those things are respected, we are for a normal, neighborly initiative, and that those things that would deliver genuine growth and prosperity across the board, not just for Gibraltar, but for the whole region, are the things that Gibraltar believes we should be doing to mutual benefit. And so, Mr. Speaker, there is no need for us to be under the cross of whatever they emerge in the next 48 or 72 hours, or under the cross of a Clause 24 style reference in negotiating guidelines, to be forced to do that which we wish to do. And I think that is what I described from what the Honourable Gentleman said, with an element of common ground between us. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman has gone to the issue of
whether we have lots of opportunity to recalibrate our future relationship with the European Union. I don't think today is the day for me to tell him that he got things wrong in his understanding of the architecture and structure of the Brexit negotiations. I just refer him to that part of my statement where I made clear that the instance of the European Union in June of 2017, I think, the EU made very clear that its interpretation of the Article 51st was that there would be first only a discussion about withdrawal. And only once withdrawal had occurred, a discussion about the future. And so, global government is saying that we have not been able to achieve that would seem like a kingdom has not been able to achieve, because it's set out in the interpretation of the Commission and of the Council in Article 60 of the Treaty as it is. In other words, you cannot do the recalibration at this stage because you won't allow it. I agree with him, but I think that was a massive mistake on the part of the European Union, because it compartmentalized the process of negotiation in the way that was neither good for the United Kingdom and therefore Gibraltar, or indeed for the European Union, but that's the political reality of the negotiators were faced. And I think if I may say so, they're sometimes subject to quite brutal criticism in some sections of the British press and in some parts of the British Parliament. But the negotiators, what are the politicians? The officials were engaged across the floor from each other who come with parameters given to them, which are in some instances unnegotiable parameters, have been exceedingly well to be able to produce accurately a document. Whether you like it more, you like it less, they produce a document. But that document does not recalibrate the relationship for the future between the United Kingdom and the European Union, because that is what the European Union is going to stop to do. There is now a political declaration that has been published, I think, an hour ago. That political declaration sets out the parameters for the discussion in the future that might lead to that recalibration. And it doesn't mention Gibraltar, because it is not mentioning the territorial scope of the discussion that is to be had. The territorial scope is set out in Article 3, which has interplay with Article 104, which is not, in my view, an act across the territorial scope, but an important reference to who is or is not covered potentially by those. As the staff of the Prime Minister, Prime Minister, and Lady Gibraltar have made repeatedly clear, if repeatedly clear, but in respect of the recalibration, I think the Honourable Government needs to read again what I said. In terms of preparedness for no deal, again, we are ready for any potential eventuality. Now, it may sound arrogant for a government to say that, especially if the government is a small community, because all of you is looking at what happens in the event of no deal. It's not just the United Kingdom that's looking at planning for all eventualities. But of course, there is only one part of Europe, apart from West Berlin, that has had to deal with a blockade in living memory. And so, I do not believe that a hard Brexit or no deal Brexit leads to a blockade. But a lot of the things that we might have wanted to consider doing in such circumstances, we already discussed as a matter of course. So, for example, we were about to form off the European grid for electricity, we then form part of the European grid of electricity. We were to form off the European mechanism for the purchase and sale of water, we could be selling water. But in so far as matters which are to be dealt with and have to come under consideration, all of them have come down into consideration, and all of them are eventualities which we are ready for. Now, our aim is therefore to ensure that people and businesses can continue to go about their ordinary lives on the 30th of March in the same way as if a hard Brexit, which we all hope doesn't happen, had not happened, and we are ready for that eventuality. And I've said, I think in the evidence I gave to the Select Committee of the House of Lords, that the planning had been done, the implementation would start after the 1st of January next year, if we were in a situation where there was not yet a deal. Now, having lived through the European brinkmanship in the past 6 months, I won't know that there isn't a deal until 11:59 on the 28th of March, I think. But certainly, if we get by the 1st of January, we need to start the implementation process in respect of the planning that we have done. I know that this is a difficult and dangerous time and that we have not involved them in decision making. Well, I think to be fair to our Savior is, of course, a reference. But if you said that somebody has done everything humanly possible and left no stone unturned, I wonder what it is that they were going to tell us to do that they haven't already said that we have done. And we're open to ideas of this, as we tell them at the end of every meeting of the Grand Select Committee. And I want to thank members of the Grand Select Committee, all of them across the floor of the House, for the work that they have done with us and the understanding that they have brought to the discussion and the useful contributions that they've made in the process of those meetings, and if I may say so, also in some instances outside the course of those meetings, and some of the things that they have said, not about the government, but about how matters should be dealt with. But we don't have a government of national unity, and we don't think there is a need for a government of national unity. And I think the fact that this nation continues to prosper and our economy continues to grow demonstrates that we were not in a situation where we could have gone for a government of national unity. And historians, therefore likely the deputy chief minister, will write for themselves in future and determine when the moments of greatest difficulty and danger arose for this community, whether it was after the referendum on the 24th of June 2016, or whether it was during the course of the joint sovereignty campaign pursued by both the governments of the United Kingdom and the government of Spain in 2002-2003. If historians conclude that the moment of greatest difficulty and danger was in 2002 and 2003 and not in 2016, then they will ergo also conclude that we did the right thing by not having a government of national unity now that there was not as much danger and difficulty as in 2002-2003, because they did not have a government of national unity in 2002-2003, or indeed a joint sovereignty select committee where they might have asked us what we thought. They only heard what we thought in the context of the debate and from the fact. Mr. Speaker, I do nonetheless think it is a little harder to say there's no ability to influence, because I think they have influenced, and Mr. Speaker in particular has put some ideas that I said in the context of my earlier discussion. Mr. Speaker, finally, I think the Honourable Gentleman dealt in his final contribution with the issue of the potential second referendum. Now, I have been on record, I think, since July 2016, saying that the terminology of second referendum was, in my view, wrong. I was partially criticised, I think, by members opposite at the time when I told the Financial Times and other international media that I did not think that there should be a second referendum, because you don't go back and ask the same question again, and that's what you describe as second. If anything, there might be a democratically legitimate opportunity. Once a deal has been done about what the future meant, to put facts to the people, as opposed to the reality of membership of the European Union. That would not be a second referendum, it would be a first referendum, a new referendum, on a new issue. Now that you know what your options really are, do you wish to A, stay as you are, B, go to this new status? I don't know whether it's possible to put a third question on the ballot paper, or a third option on the ballot paper, that might be democratically not so valid, and the Electoral Commission might have something to say about that. But my view was very clear in July 2016, and I haven't changed my view, that the political reality that this committee has to deal with is that that is not an option at the moment. If it were to become an option, and I think Mr. Deacon has said something about that very explicitly in that respect, with which I do not disagree, if that were to become an option, then the position of the government of Gibraltar, and I think the position of this parliament as a whole, would be that having put stipulation in the 2016 referendum, the people of Gibraltar should, of course, also be included in the franchise for that future consultation. People's vote, as it's now called in the vernacular. I think I've dealt with all the matters that the Honourable Gentleman has raised. I've dealt with that already in the context of 2002-2003.
The Honourable Mandela Hassanov.
Mr. Speaker, I rise to seek clarification on a point, but also I would like to take this opportunity to thank the Gibraltar and the UK government for their hard work and solid defence of our people by protecting our sovereignty and constitutional position in the draft withdrawal agreement, as well as the rest of the work they have done and continue doing at this key juncture of Brexit negotiations, which are, of course, so crucial and vital for the people of Gibraltar. I am pleased to note the optimism of the Chief Minister and that we are at a stage where the memorandum of understanding between us and Spain is reaching its final. Satan with what looks like a reasonable set of agreements for the future. Of course, Mr. Speaker, we have to remain aware of the reality that we still have to await to see how the withdrawal agreement will be voted on in Parliament. Because without the withdrawal agreement passing through Westminster, Mr. Speaker, all of these agreements could well come to nothing. And I therefore sincerely hope this will not be the case. I would like to seek clarification from the Honourable the Chief Minister regarding Spain's position on discussing the matter of joint sovereignty. Spain has openly talked about the tabling of this issue for future talks or negotiations, so I would like to ask how the Chief Minister will manage this aim of the Spanish government and whether it would stand any chance of impeding a workable deal which benefits both sides of the border. Would that be our own backstop, Mr. Speaker?
Minister. I want to thank the Honourable Lady for her contribution today. Indeed, all her contributions from this debate and this issue, and I've updated the House in the time that I have been trying to ensure that the community gets as much of the information on Brexit that we are able to share. I'm sorry that I just needed to read that message coming in. If I may, Mr. Speaker, I think the Honourable Lady is raising a point of the Honourable Gentleman that he raised in the course of his statement and that I did not hear. I don't know whether that's what the Honourable Gentleman was pointing out to me. So it is absolutely true that the Honourable Lady would have discussed, I think, two or three occasions when some who have current responsibility have said that they will be considering tabling the potential for joint sovereignty in the context of the negotiation of what future arrangements should apply between the Volta and the European Union. Well, Mr. Speaker, I've heard it a lot, actually, in the last 3 months. But I've heard it more from those who do not have responsibility than from those that do have responsibility. Now, I think this is an important point, because the Honourable Lady will know in her work with us in respect to the Brexit Select Committee. So the really seminal moment comes when the former Spanish Foreign Minister, Ian Mayall, is moved on by his party, and Alfonso Vázquez, until then a career diplomat, in fact, the permanent representative in Brussels, in Spain, became the Foreign Secretary of Spain. So what that has moved matters on quite considerably and quite quickly. And he was the one who set out the new Spanish position after Senor Margarita. That the issue of sovereignty would not form part of Spain's claims in the context of the withdrawal of agreement. So when we were in a position of responsibility, the Partido Popular and Alfonso Vázquez were not pursuing joint sovereignty. I think it is true to say that there are nuances in what they said which limited that position to the stage of withdrawal, not also to the future negotiation. So, Mr. Speaker, I thought the best and clearest position of this was actually put by Spanish State Secretary Marco Aguirano, who I had the pleasure to meet earlier this week. And in a statement that he, in an interview that he gave last week, when he was quizzed as to why they haven't put joint sovereignty to the Gibraltarians in the context of this discussion, he said, well, they do, they can, but they'll get up and go. And yesterday, in a radio interview, he said that he had been in meetings with the top tier of Gibraltarian representation and negotiations and were asked whether he could be considered something different, they would just literally have shut their back and gone. That everybody in Spain understands that the people of Gibraltar are no closer to accepting the principle of dilution of our sovereignty today than we were in 2002, 2003, the moment of the greatest difficulty and danger that we may have faced until June 2016. Or 1967, when it was left with us, the sooner that we can move on to a mature and genuine political relationship between Edwards. So, absolutely, it should be clear beyond peradventure if whoever is misguided enough to want to countenance it. But the people of the world will never call it sovereignty's right. In particular, for something as esoteric as the single market. I mean, I don't know that people have not misinterpreted in some way what our 96% support for remaining in the European Union means. Now, the people who have voted 96% to remain in the European Union because we thought that was the best way to defend ourselves against the Spanish sovereignty claim. Not that we are so pro-European, although we don't believe in the European project and its ideology, but we are prepared to pay even with a sovereignty right to stay in the European Union. That would be the upside-down interpretation of our 96% vote. And so, Mr. Speaker, it heartens me to hear serving politicians of the Spanish government recognize that putting the issue of sovereignty and joint sovereignty is not going to lead to anything other than the negotiations not being able to flourish because the Germans are not going to engage in it. And I think it helps to evidence where people are in the democratic spectrum when there are others who say that it could be imposed. Mr. Speaker, but those who seek to impose sovereignty on any others are not playing the democratic game. Now, the conclusion of democratic games can go any way the people want. But the imposition of will, Mr. Speaker, can only go one way as far as I'm concerned. And that is right out the door. And I know that I speak for everyone in this Parliament. And when I say that, and when I say that the government is supposed to, whoever might be forming the executive would never be prepared to countenance any proposal of joint sovereignty that would be put. And that is that. The sooner we move on from that, the sooner we move on to a good, modern relationship based on good neighbourhood.
The Honourable Daniel Peaton. Just one point of clarification.
Because this is the Honourable Chief Minister agree with us that it is important that the United Kingdom hold a line in respect of Article 3 and the definition of the United Kingdom which currently includes Gibraltar and interplay with Article 184, and that in holding that line it is important that the United Kingdom government does not agree to any watering down of language that gives Spain the hope that it may be able in the future to extort concessions on sovereignty, jurisdiction and control at a price for reaching a permanent deal in respect of the Gibraltar and its permanent relationship with the United Kingdom. And indeed, Mr. Speaker, that it is only by the United Kingdom being firm with Spain that Spain will understand that actually it really wants to agree something that is of mutual benefit to Gibraltar and the neighbouring region, which can be a very positive, very beneficial agreement, but the only way to do so is, in fact, the partnership of 17 jurisdictions and control. And that today would be a bad time, indeed, to be agreeing to any watering down of language in the current withdrawal agreement.
I think that's a useful point to clarify the government's understanding of what the state of the text is. And I think the understanding of governments around Europe is that the withdrawal agreement text is closed. In other words, the Article 3 text and the Article 1 of CETA form part of the withdrawal agreement, which includes the protocol, and is closed text. And the future framework, the political declaration and the future framework, is also closed text. And therefore, that there would be no change to the text of Article 3 and the text of Article 104. Now, there may be interpretive notes, there may be declarations, treaties. Once agreed, are immediately the subject of buyer's remorse by one side and the other, and immediately declarations are made about interpretations, etc. I would imagine that the airwaves are full of discussions about things at the moment. But as long as we protect our sound, everything else in international law does not have the standard of enforceability that legal text might have. But people have to pay. The provisions of Article 184 are provisions about an agreement to agree. And that is something that the government is supposed to believe should be honored in good faith. And the best demonstration of good faith that we have seen has been the repeated position of the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, who has set out that he is negotiating from the word go, Mr. Speaker, for the whole of the British family, including Gibraltar. And there were some who doubted whether he would see that through into the withdrawal agreement and Gibraltar inclusion in the withdrawal agreement. Well, Mr. Speaker, Gibraltar is now included in the withdrawal agreement and in the conditional agreement. So those who doubted the Prime Minister have at least got that piece of evidence to reassure them that he has stood their ground right the way through to the closing of the text and were in the agreement and in the conditional period, as long as there is an agreement and there is a transitional period. We are in there with Britain. And the position the Prime Minister has set out in relation to the application of 184 and the view of the United Kingdom is that she is negotiating those future arrangements in respect of the whole of the UK family, including Gibraltar, for the benefit of the UK family, including Gibraltar. And I think that is a clear, robust statement of position, which he is now entitled to ask us to be less cynical and less sceptical about. And I think everybody in this house is rightly cynical and sceptical about the assurances given to Gibraltar by UK politicians. So even though I think it's one of the few who is entitled to say, I've demonstrated to you that I gave you an assurance and I've seen it through. And yeah, because in this phase one and phase two period in which we have been engaged, we have had delivered to us the two things that we were assuring of. Access to the UK market, phase one, access to the withdrawal agreement and the transitional period, such as it may be if there is such an agreement by Sunday. I said, the Liberal government is absolutely right. But the best way to create confidence in Gibraltar is for the United Kingdom to be robust in their assurances of Gibraltar and to stand by those assurances. What happens when Gibraltar is confident that the UK has our back is that we're confident in being able to engage in safe dialogue with our neighbour. And that, Mr. Speaker, helps us to get over the very difficult history that we've had with our neighbour and to demonstrate our skills in relation to our neighbour, flexible and cynical approach to their approach to negotiation, but to at least demonstrate our willingness to engage in our debate in trying to reach arrangements which are for the common benefit of all, always with what we might call in our bilingualism the fly behind our ear, that they will then actually perform on the obligations. And always now, and if you are the will agree with me on this, always now, post the court of our experience, extensive court of our experience, £84 million in an airport and the sanitation is still being paid, some of you guys have a wish to see stopped. Always now knowing that we must calibrate our performance in a way that plays off continued standard performance. So we should not give open-ended commitments to perform obligations which are not linked to same performing obligations. Now, all of that, Mr. Speaker, with a robust Prime Minister behind you, who has demonstrated that she does what she says, and that she doesn't wobble at the knees as some others might have done, and at the last minute give way, that is what builds confidence and enables us to go forward. And that's what she's done on phase one, market access to the United Kingdom, and that's what she's done on phase two, which is the withdrawal agreement and the transitional provision. And a lot of people thought that we would not be in the position that we are today. We don't need the support of the United Kingdom. We are there. And I think the British government has recognized that in the way that we pose this question, for which I'm grateful. And Mr. Speaker, of course, the best next step in that analysis is the same to continue to pass matters of sovereignty, jurisdiction, and control in order to be able to advance in areas which are not infected either by our very clear, I'm always impressed by our impossible way of expressing this, Mr. Speaker, the large red line on those issues, and indeed on the ingredients of sovereignty, jurisdiction, and control, which are as important as sovereignty, jurisdiction, and control simplicity, and to be able to engage with us, Mr. Speaker, in a way that enables us to the agreement and the arrangement that ordinary people who benefit from cross-frontier movements, whether it's for trade or for personal reasons, to be able to benefit from that. If there is something, Mr. Speaker, then I think it is helpful to have had, in particular highlighted in the context of withdrawal, not the future, just withdrawal, it is the recognition of the benefit and value to the whole region of freedom of movement in the period of common membership from the European Union. All members will know from their reading of the Gibraltar Protocol to the withdrawal agreement that that is specifically recognized in the UK EU document, Mr. Speaker. And I think that plays as well for an understanding of the importance of free movement going forward as we negotiate the future arrangement between the United Kingdom and the European Union, and it will be a particular benefit in this part of the world. I think that with everything that we have been able to deal with, I'll give way if you want to.
Thank you. All right, Clinton.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I just want to ask the Speaker for a very narrow point in relation to the tax treaty, which we discussed briefly last time in our chat. And I know that this time we have a document for a double tax or as a sort of thing used to in a double tax treaty. But I want to ask you the two things there are two things. One, if we this treaty capable of surviving or being put into effect in its own right outside a withdrawal agreement. And secondly, what I'm trying to say is it dependent entirely on the withdrawal agreement, if it exists on its own right, in its own right. And secondly, given that it would survive the 2-year transition period, how long would this tax treaty be for? Does it not have an individual term date? I haven't said that we are entering into a double taxation agreement with Spain, having said that we were not going to. What I said was that there are tax residency rules which we are dealing with in that agreement, of that type found in double taxation and information exchange agreements. So, because the word decision is important in a parliament where we're discussing our words. So, I think it's important that the Honourable Gentleman have a look at the text of my statement when it is published, and he addresses what I said rather than what he wishes he had heard. Because the tax agreement is not limited to completion to drop dead on the 31st of December 2020. I think I made very clear it was the full memoranda that fall dead on that date. Because the tax agreement is not something to put in place in such a short period. You need time to ensure that people are aware of the rules and to be able to make assessments which bring people and their information within the provisions of the agreement. Neither do we wish for there to be a definite period for determination of the obligations under the agreement. We want this to endure, Mr. Speaker. One of the issues that Spain has repeatedly used in the international media and Gibraltar is the issue of taxation, and therefore reaching an arrangement with respect to taxation with Spain is something that we want to see endure so that that weapon is not available in the past. We genuinely want to have an open and transparent relationship with Spain, as we do with many other nations, and not none of the others of which are unable in respect of taxation so far as it goes to residency rules, etc. So that is one of the agreements that will not end at the end of December, and I think I said this explicitly. I think the Honourable Lord of the Commission recognised explicitly that I said that the Citizens' Rights Memorandum and the tax agreement were aligned with did not end at the 31st of December.
Now, the Honourable Member wish to hold any question? The standing order, the Honourable Chief Minister.
I said to move under standing order 7-3, the defense standing order 7-1. We want to proceed with government force.
All in favor? All against? Carried.
So, first and second reading. A bill for an act to amend the Crimes Act 2011 so as to make certain acts of voyeurism an offence. The Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to amend the Crimes Act 2011 so as to make certain acts of voyeurism an offence to be read in first time.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Crimes Act 2011 to make certain acts of voyeurism an offence be read a first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Crimes Amendment Act 2018.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill be now read a second time. Mr. Speaker, this bill makes certain acts of voyeurism commonly referred to as outskirting an offence in Gibraltar. This item includes the tactics typically involved defenders taking a picture and then passing clothing without them knowing. This unacceptable practice has been significant to media attention in recent months, especially in the UK, where a campaign was led by victim Gina Martin. Gina was at a music festival in London when two men took indecent photographs of her behind their phone cameras under a skirt when she was distracted. These images were then shared by the men on WhatsApp. Reports suggest that in the UK, there have been 78 cases of upskirting recorded by police since 2005, although they have been prosecuted under other existing offences, such as the offence of outraging public decency. Gina contends for upskirting to be specifically made an offence, and a private member's bill was submitted to Parliament. It did not pass its second reading due to an objection by Sir Christopher Chase MP, who has a national principle objects to all private bills. However, at the next outbreak, understandable in my mind, the UK Prime Minister, the Right Honourable Speaker, May MP, quickly intervened and adopted the measure as a government bill. The UK bill is still working its way to the House of Parliament. There is no harm, Mr. Speaker, and I think everything to be gained, to criminalise specifically this vile behaviour. I now turn to the causes of the bill. 4C2 introduces the offences under a new section, 293A, entitled Voyeurism Additional Offences. Section 1 makes it an offence for a person to operate equipment underneath a person's clothes without their consent, for the purpose of obtaining social gratification or to cause humiliation, distress, or alarm to that person. Subsection 2 says that a similar offence for recording an image of the youth and other person's clothing for the same purposes. Subsection 4 stipulates that these offences will carry a penalty on summary conviction of imprisonment for 12 months, or the statutory maximum fine or both. A conviction or indictment will carry 2 years imprisonment. Clause 3-4 amends Table 3 of the Act by adding a new section 2-9-8 for this offences. Part 13 of the Act, which deals with notification requirements and orders for relating sex offenders, applies to all those offences listed in Part 13, which will now, of course, include the new section 239A. Mr. Speaker, I commend the bill to the House.
Before I put the question, does any honourable member wish to speak upon general principles and then for this bill?
Yes, I indicate that it will be under support.
Do you have a bullet from Venice?
No, just simply to inform the clerk it is our indication to support the government.
Very well.
Mr.
Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill be now read a second time. The Honourable Samantha for comment.
Mr. Speaker, attempting to take a photograph under the skirt, also known as image-based sexual abuse, is a gross violation of privacy and potentially an act of indecency. And whichever way, this is a form of sexual harassment. This offence, Mr. Speaker, will mainly affect women for obvious reasons, and therefore this law serves to protect women from these circumstances. And as Minister for Equality, I'm pleased to recommend a specific law barrier of achievement from the equality line. So to think that any form of sexual abuse is an infringement against the rights of women, and as most victims of the fact will be women, it constitutes discrimination against women on the grounds of her sex. This new offence serves to enhance the recognition of women's rights to privacy, dignity, and sexual expression. We must do everything possible to protect women and girls from sexual offences and ensure that those committing such offences are punished, and therefore, Mr. Speaker, I commend the vote for this.
Is there any other contribution to the second reading of the bill? I will therefore now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Crimes Act 2011 so as to make certain acts of voyeurism and offence be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Crimes Amendment Act 2018.
I beg to notice that the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken today if all honourable members agree.
Do all honourable members agree that the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken today? Committee stage and third reading, the honourable consensus.
Because the honourable members of the House of Resolvent Services Committee to consider the following bill clause by clause. Crimes Amendment Act
2018. I therefore ask to amend the Crimes Act 2011 so as to make certain acts of voyeurism an offence. Clauses 1 to 3. Third part of the bill. The long title. Third part of the bill.
The honest report that the Crimes Amendment Act 2018 has been considered in committee and has been approved of without amendment. And I move that it should now be considered a third time in time.
Now, the other question is that a bill for an act to amend the Crimes Act 2011 so as to prevent certain acts of voyeurism and offence being read a third time in time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
I have the honour to move that the House should now adjourn to Thursday the 6th of December at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Speaker, given what we anticipate will be the timetable of progress at a European level, it is anticipated, nothing is clear as anticipated, that we may be able to see a whole suite of documentation that refers to the House should be published either late in the weekend or early during the course of next week. I could then have an opportunity of letting honourable members have it probably long before that, if I can, by close of business on Friday, I hope to be able to let them have that documentation. And that then there should be a period for the whole community to be able to see the documentation. I expect them, as I said, to make a ministerial statement, and then to come to this House to be able to have the debate in this House, Mr. Speaker. So the honourable members are able to put to the community their views in respect of those documents and what I have said about them in the context of the ministerial statement. So I move the House of now adjourn to Thursday the 6th of December at 3 p.m.
I will now adjourn to Thursday the 6th of December at 3 in the afternoon.